before such cogent reasoning, and the cardinals were consequently invited to dinner. The table was laid in a vineyard belonging to the Pope, near Saint-Pierre-et-Liens, a charming retreat which the cardinals knew very well by report. Rospigliosi, quite giddy with his dignity, prepared his stomach and assumed his best looks. Spada, a prudent man and greatly attached to his only nephew, a young captain of highest promise, took paper and pen and made his will. He then sent to his nephew to await him in the vicinity of the vineyard, but it appeared the servant did not find him. Spada knew the nature of these invitations. Since Christianity, so eminently civilizing, had made progress in Rome, it was no longer a centurion who came from the tyrant with a message, "Caesar wills that you die," but it was a legate a latere who came with a smile on his lips to say from the Pope, "His Holiness requests you will dine with him." Spada set out about 2 o'clock to Saint-Pierre-et-Liens. The Pope awaited him. The first figure that struck the eyes of Spada was that of his nephew in full costume, and Caesar Borgia paying him most marked attentions. Spada turned pale as Caesar looked at him with an ironical air, which proved that he had anticipated all and that the snare was well spread. They began dinner, and Spada was only able to inquire of his nephew if he had received his message. The nephew replied, "No," perfectly comprehending the meaning of the question. It was too late, for he had already drank a glass of excellent wine, placed for him expressly by the Pope's butler. Spada, at the same moment, saw another bottle approach him, which he was pressed to taste. An hour afterwards, a physician declared they were both poisoned through eating mushrooms. Spada died on the threshold of the vineyard. The nephew expired at his own door, making signs which his wife could not comprehend. Then Caesar and the Pope hastened to lay hands on the heritage, under pretense of seeking for the papers of the dead man. But the inheritance consisted in this only, a scrap of paper on which Spada had written, "I bequeath to my beloved nephew my coffers, my books, and, amongst other, my breviary and the gold corners, which I beg he will preserve in remembrance of his affectionate uncle." The heirs sought everywhere, admired the breviary, laid hands on the furniture, and were greatly astonished that Spada, the rich man, was really the most miserable of uncles. No treasures, unless they were those of science composed in the library and laboratories. This was all. Caesar and his father searched, examined, scrutinized, but found nothing, or at least very little, not exceeding a few thousand crowns in plate and about the same in ready money. But the nephew had time to say to his wife before he expired, "Look well among my uncle's papers. There is a will." They sought even more thoroughly than the august heirs had done, but it was fruitless. There were 2 palaces and a vineyard behind the Palatine Hill, but in these days landed property had not much value, and the 2 palaces and the vineyard remained to the family as beneath the rapacity of the Pope and his son. Months and years rolled on. Alexander VI died, poisoned, you know by what mistake. Caesar, poisoned at the same time, escaped with colouring his skin like a snake and assumed a new cuticle on which the poison left spots like those we see on the skin of a tiger. Then, compelled to quit Rome, he went and killed himself in obscurity in a night skirmish scarcely noticed in history. After the Pope's death and his son's exile, it was supposed the Spada family would again make the splendid figure they had before the cardinal's time. But this was not the case. The Spadas remained in doubtful ease. A mystery hung over this dark affair, and the public rumour was that Caesar, a better politician than his father, had carried off from the Pope the fortune of the two cardinals. I say the two because Cardinal Rospigliosi, who had not taken any precaution, was completely despoiled. Up to this time, said Faria, interrupting the thread of his narrative, this seems to you very ridiculous, no doubt, eh? Oh, my friend, said Dantès, on the contrary, it seems as if I were reading a most interesting narrative. Go on, I pray of you. I will. The family began to feel accustomed to this obscurity. Years rolled on, and amongst the descendants some were soldiers, others diplomatists, some churchmen, some bankers, some grew rich and some were ruined. I come now to the last of the family, whose secretary I was, the Comte de Spada. I had often heard him complain of the disproportion of his rank with his fortune, and I advised him to sink all he had in an annuity. He did so, and thus doubled his income. The celebrated breviary remained in the family, and was in the Comte's possession. It had been handed down from father to son, for the singular clause of the only will that had been found had rendered it a real relic, preserved in the family with superstitious veneration. It was an illuminated book with beautiful Gothic characters, and so weighty with gold that a servant always carried it before the cardinal on days of great solemnity. At the sight of papers of all sorts, titles, contracts, parchments, which were kept in the archives of the family, all descending from the poisoned cardinal, I, like 20 servitors, stewards, secretaries before me, in my turn, examined the immense bundles of documents. But in spite of the most accurate researches, I found nothing. Yet I had read, I had even written, a precise history of the Borgia family, for the sole purpose of assuring myself whether any increase of fortune had occurred to them on the death of the Cardinal Cesar Spada, but could only trace the acquisition of the property of the Cardinal Rospigliosi, his companion in misfortune. I was then almost assured that the inheritance had neither profited the Borgias nor the family, but had remained unpossessed like the treasures of the Arabian Nights, which slept in the bosom of the earth under the eyes of a genie. I searched, ransacked, counted, calculated 1,000 and 1,000 times the income and expenditure of the family for 300 years. It was useless. I remained in my ignorance, and the Comte de Spada in his poverty. My patron died. He had reserved from his annuity, his family papers, his library composed of 5,000 volumes, and his famous breviary. All these he bequeathed to me with 1,000 Roman crowns, which he had in ready money, on condition that I would have said anniversary masses for the repose of his soul, and that I would draw up a genealogical tree and history of his house. All this I did scrupulously. Be easy, my dear Edmund, we are near the conclusion. In 1807, a month before I was arrested, and 15 days after the death of Comte Spada, on the 25th of December, you will see presently how the date became fixed in my memory, I was reading for the 1,000th time the papers I was arranging for the palace was sold to a stranger, and I was going to leave Rome and settle at Florence, intending to take with me 12,000 francs I possessed, my library and famous breviary, when, tired with my constant labour at the same thing, and overcome by a heavy dinner I had eaten, my head dropped on my hands and I fell asleep. About 3 o'clock in the afternoon, I awoke as the clock was striking 6. I raised my head. All was in darkness. I rang for a light, but as no one came, I determined to find one for myself. It was indeed the habit of a philosopher which I should soon be under the necessity of adopting. I took a wax candle in one hand and with the other groped about for a piece of paper, my matchbox being empty, with which I hoped to produce a light from the small flame still playing on the embers. Fearing, however, to make use of any valuable piece of paper, I hesitated for a moment, then recollected that I had seen in the famous breviary which was on the table beside me an old paper, quite yellow with age, and which had served as a marker for centuries, kept there by the request of the heirs. I felt for it, found it, twisted it up together, and, putting it into the expiring flame, set light to it. But beneath my fingers, as if by magic, in proportion as the fire ascended, I saw yellowish characters appear on the paper. I grasped it in my hand, put out the flame as quickly as I could, lighted my taper in the fire itself, and opened the crumpled paper with inexpressible emotion, recognizing when I had done so that these characters had been traced in mysterious and sympathetic ink, only appearing when exposed to the fire. Nearly one-third of the paper had been consumed by the flame. It was that paper you read this morning. Read it again, Dantes, and then I will complete for you the incomplete words and unconnected sense. Faria, with an air of triumph, offered the paper to Dantes, who this time read the following words traced with an ink of a colour which most nearly resembled rust. This 25th day of April, 1498, be Alexander the Sixth, and fearing that not, he may desire to become my heir, and re, and Bentivoglio, who were poisoned, my sole heir that I have, and has visited with me, that is, in Island of Monte Cristo, all I pos, jewels, diamonds, gems, that I alone may amount to nearly 2 mil, will find on raising the 20th raw creek to the east in a right line, 2 open. In these caves the treasure is in the furthest which treasure I bequeath and leave in as my sole heir. Says 25th April, 1498. And now, said the abbe, read this other paper. And he presented to Dantes a second leaf with fragments of lines written on it, which Edmund read as follows. Ing invited to dine with His Holiness, content with making me pay for my hat, serves for me the fate of Cardinals Caprara. I declare to my nephew Guido Spada, rid in a place he knows, the caves of the small est of ingots gold money, know of the existence of this treasure which Leons of Roman crowns, and which he from the small ings have been made ingle in the second tire to him are Spada. Faria followed him with excited look, and now, he said, when he saw Dantes had read the last line, put the two fragments together and judge for yourself. Dantes obeyed, and the conjoined pieces gave the following. This 25th day of April, 1498, being invited to dine with His Holiness Alexander the Sixth, and fearing that not content with making me pay for my hat, he may desire to become my heir, and reserves for me the fate of Cardinals Caprara and Bentivoglio, who were poisoned, I declare to my nephew Guido Spada, my sole heir, that I have buried in a place he knows and has visited with me, that is in the caves of the small island of Monte Cristo. All I possessed of ingots, gold, money, jewels, diamonds, gems, that I alone know of the existence of this treasure, which may amount to nearly 2 millions of Roman crowns, and which he will find on raising the 20th rock from the small creek to the east in a right line. 2 openings have been made in these caves. The treasure is in the furthest angle in the second, which treasure I bequeath and leave entire to him as my sole heir. Cesar Spada, 25th April, 1498. Well, do you comprehend now? Inquired Faria. It is the declaration of Cardinal Spada and the will so long sought for, replied Edmund, still incredulous. Of course! What else could it be? And who completed it as it now is? I did. Aided by the remaining fragment, I guessed the rest. Measuring the length of the lines by those of the paper, and divining the hidden meaning by means of what was in part revealed, as we are guided in a cavern by the small ray of light above us. And what did you do when you arrived at this conclusion? I resolved to set out, and did set out that very instant, carrying with me the beginning of my great work on forming Italy into one kingdom. But for some time the infernal police, who, at this period, quite contrary to what Napoleon desired so soon as he had a son born to him, wished for a partition of provinces, had their eyes on me and my hasty departure, the cause of which they were unable to guess. Having aroused their suspicions, I was arrested at the very moment I was leaving Piombino. Now, continued Faria, addressing Dantès with an almost paternal expression, now, my dear fellow, you know as much as I do myself. If we ever escape together, half this treasure is yours. If I die here and you escape alone, the whole belongs to you. But, inquired Dantès, hesitating, has this treasure no more legitimate possessor in this world than ourselves? No, no, be easy on that score. The family is extinct. The last Comte de Spada, moreover, made me his heir. Bequeathing to me this symbolic breviary, he bequeathed to me all it contained. No, no, make your mind satisfied on that point. If we lay hands on this fortune, we may enjoy it without remorse. And you say this treasure amounts to 2 millions of Roman crowns, nearly 13 millions of our money. Impossible, said Dantès, staggered at the enormous amount. Impossible? And why? Asked the old man. The Spada family was one of the oldest and most powerful families of the 15th century, and in these times, when all speculation and occupation were wanting, those accumulations of gold and jewels were by no means rare. There are at this day Roman families perishing of hunger, though possessed of nearly 1 million in diamonds and jewels handed down as heirlooms and which they cannot touch. Edmund thought he was in a dream. He wavered between incredulity and joy. I have only kept this secret so long from you, continued Faria, that I might prove you and then surprise you. Had we escaped before my attack of catalepsy, I should have conducted you to Monte Cristo. Now, he added with a sigh, it is you who will conduct me thither. Well, Dantès, you do not thank me. This treasure belongs to you, my dear friend, replied Dantès, and to you only. I have no right to it. I am no relation of yours. You are my son, Dantès, exclaimed the old man. You are the child of my captivity. My profession condemns me to celibacy. God has sent you to me to console, at one and the same time, the man who could not be a father, and the prisoner who could not get free. And Faria extended the arm of which alone the use remained to him to the young man, who threw himself upon his neck and wept bitterly. 19. The Death of the Abbe. Now that this treasure, which had so long been the object of the Abbe's meditations, could ensure the future happiness of him whom Faria really loved as a son, it had doubled its value in his eyes, and every day he expatiated on the amount, explaining to Dantès all the good which, with 13 or 14 millions of francs, a man could do in these days to his friends. And then Dante's countenance became gloomy, for the oath of vengeance he had taken recurred to his memory, and he reflected how much ill in these times a man with 13 or 14 millions could do to his enemies. The abbe did not know the Isle of Monte Cristo, but Dantès knew it, and had often passed it, situated 25 miles from Pianosa, between Corsica and the Isle of Elba, and had once touched at it. This island was, always had been, and still is, completely deserted. It is a rock of almost conical form, which seems as though produced by some volcanic effort from the depths to the surface of the ocean. Dantès traced a plan of the island to Faria, and Faria gave Dantès advice as to the means he should employ to recover the treasure. But Dantès was far from being as enthusiastic and confident as the old man. It was past a question now that Faria was not a lunatic, and the way in which he had achieved the discovery, which had given rise to the suspicion of his madness, increased his admiration of him. But at the same time, he could not believe that that deposit, supposing it had ever existed, still existed, and though he considered the treasure as by no means chimerical, he yet believed it was no longer there. However, as if fate resolved on depriving the prisoners of their last chance and making them understand that they were condemned to perpetual imprisonment, a new misfortune befell them. The gallery on the seaside, which had long been in ruins, was rebuilt. They had repaired it completely and stopped up with vast masses of stone the hole Dantès had partly filled in. But for this precaution, which, it will be remembered, the abbe had made to Edmund, the misfortune would have been still greater, for their attempt to escape would have been detected, and they would undoubtedly have been separated. Thus, a fresh and even stronger door was closed upon them. "You see," said the young man with an air of sorrowful resignation to Faria, "that God deems it right to take from me even what you call my devotion to you. I have promised you to remain for ever with you, and now I could not break my promise if I would. I shall no more have the treasure than you, and neither of us will quit this prison. But my real treasure is not that, my dear friend, which awaits me beneath the sombre rocks of Monte Cristo, but it is your presence, our living together 5 or 6 hours a day in spite of our jailers. It is those rays of intelligence you have elicited from my brain, the languages you have implanted in my memory, and which spring there with all their philological ramifications. These different sciences that you have made so easy to me by the depth of the knowledge you possess of them, and the clearness of the principles to which you have reduced them, this is my treasure, my beloved friend, and with this you have made me rich and happy. Believe me, and take comfort. This is better for me than tons of gold and cases of diamonds, even were they not as problematical as the clouds we see in the morning floating over the sea which we take for terra firma, and which evaporate and vanish as we draw near to them. To have you as long as possible near me, to hear your eloquent voice, which I trust embellishes my mind, strengthens my soul, and makes my whole frame capable of great and terrible things if I should ever be free, so fills my whole existence that the despair to which I was just on the point of yielding when I knew you has no longer any hold over me. And this is my fortune, not chimerical but actual. I owe you my real good, my present happiness, and all the sovereigns of the earth, were they Caesar Borgias, could not deprive me of this."
Thus, if not actually happy, yet the days these two unfortunates passed together went quickly. Faria, who for so long a time had kept silence as to the treasure, now perpetually talked of it. As he had said, he remained paralyzed in the right arm and the left leg, and had given up all hope of ever enjoying it himself. But he was continually thinking over some means of escape for his young companion, and he enjoyed it for him. For fear the letter might be some day lost or abstracted, he compelled Dantès to learn it by heart, and he thus knew it from one end to the other. Then he destroyed the second portion, assured that if the first were seized, no one would be able to penetrate its real meaning. Whole hours sometimes passed whilst Faria was giving instructions to Dantès, instructions which were to serve him when he was at liberty. Then, once free, from the day and hour and moment when he was so, he could have but one only thought, which was to gain Monte Cristo by some means, and remain there alone under some pretext, which would give no suspicions, and once there to endeavour to find the wonderful caverns and search in the appointed spot, the appointed spot, be it remembered, being the farthest angle in the second opening. In the meanwhile, the hours passed, if not rapidly, at least tolerably. Faria, as we have said, without having recovered the use of his hand and foot, had resumed all the clearness of his understanding, and had gradually, besides the moral instructions we have detailed, taught his youthful companion the patient and sublime duty of a prisoner who learns to make something from nothing. They were thus perpetually employed. Faria, that he might not see himself grow old, Dantès, for fear of recalling the almost extinct past, which now only floated in his memory like a distant light wandering in the night. All went on as if in existences in which misfortune has deranged nothing, and which glide on mechanically and tranquilly beneath the eye of Providence. But beneath this superficial calm, there were, in the heart of the young man, and perhaps in that of the old man, many repressed desires, many stifled sighs, which found vent when Faria was left alone, and when Edmund returned to his cell. One night Edmund awoke suddenly, believing he heard someone calling him. He opened his eyes and tried to pierce through the gloom. His name, or rather a plaintive voice which essayed to pronounce his name, reached him. "Alas," murmured Edmund, "can it be?" He moved his bed, drew up the stone, rushed into the passage, and reached the opposite extremity. The secret entrance was open. By the light of the wretched and wavering lamp of which we have spoken, Dantès saw the old man, pale but yet erect, clinging to the bedstead. His features were writhing with those horrible symptoms which he already knew, and which had so seriously alarmed him when he saw them for the first time. "Alas, my dear friend," said Faria, in a resigned tone, "you understand, do you not? And I need not attempt to explain to you." Edmund uttered a cry of agony, and quite out of his senses, rushed towards the door, exclaiming, "Help! Help!" Faria had just sufficient strength to retain him. "Silence," he said, "or you are lost. Think now of yourself only, my dear friend. Act so as to render your captivity supportable or your flight possible. It would require years to renew only what I have done here, and which would be instantly destroyed if our jailers knew we had communicated with each other. Besides, be assured, my dear Edmund, the dungeon I am about to leave will not long remain empty. Some other unfortunate being will soon take my place, and to him you will appear like an angel of salvation. Perhaps he will be young, strong, and enduring like yourself, and will aid you in your escape whilst I have been but a hindrance. You will no longer have half a dead body tied to you to paralyze all your movements. At length Providence has done something for you. He restores to you more than he takes away, and it was time I should die." Edmund could only clasp his hands and exclaim, "Oh, my friend, speak not thus," and then resuming all his presence of mind, which had for a moment staggered under this blow, and his strength, which had failed at the words of the old man, he said, "Oh, I have saved you once, and I will save you a second time," and raising the foot of the bed, he drew out the phial, still a third filled with the red liquor. "See," he exclaimed, "there remains still some of this saving draught. Quick! Quick, tell me what I must do this time. Are there any fresh instructions? Speak, my friend, I listen." "There is not a hope," replied Faria, shaking his head. "But no matter. God wills it that man, whom he has created, and in whose heart he has so profoundly rooted the love of life, should do all in his power to preserve that existence which, however painful it may be, is yet always so dear." "Oh, yes, yes," exclaimed Dantès, "and I tell you, you shall be saved." "Well then, try. The cold gains upon me. I feel the blood flowing towards my brain. This horrible trembling which makes my teeth chatter and seems to dislocate my bones begins to pervade my whole frame. In 5 minutes the malady will reach its height, and in a quarter of an hour there will be nothing left of me but a dead corpse." "Oh," exclaimed Dantès, his heart wrung with anguish. "Do as you did before, only do not wait so long. All the springs of life are now exhausted in me, and death," he continued, looking at his paralyzed arm and leg, "has but half its work to do. If, after having made me swallow 12 drops instead of 10, you see that I do not recover, then pour the rest down my throat. Now lift me on my bed, for I can no longer support myself." Edmund took the old man in his arms and laid him on the bed. "And now, my dear friend," said Faria, "sole consolation of my wretched existence, you, whom heaven gave me somewhat late, but still gave me a priceless gift, and for which I am most grateful, at the moment of separating from you for ever, I wish you all the happiness and all the prosperity you so well deserve. My son, I bless thee." The young man cast himself on his knees, leaning his head against the old man's bed. "Listen now to what I say in this, my dying moment. The treasure of the Spadas exists. God grants me that there no longer exists for me distance or obstacle. I see it in the depths of the inner cavern. My eyes pierce the inmost recesses of the earth and are dazzled at the sight of so much riches. If you do escape, remember that the poor abbe, whom all the world called mad, was not so. Hasten to Monte Cristo, avail yourself of the fortune, for you have indeed suffered long enough." A violent shock interrupted the old man. Dantès raised his head and saw Faria's eyes injected with blood. It seemed as if a flow of blood had ascended from the chest to the head. "Adieu. Adieu," murmured the old man, clasping Edmund's hand convulsively. "Adieu. Oh, no, no, not yet," he cried. "Do not forsake me. Oh, succor him. Help, help, help." "Hush, hush," murmured the dying man, "that they may not separate us if you save me." "You are right. Oh, yes, yes, be assured I shall save you. Besides, although you suffer much, you do not seem in such agony as before. Do not mistake. I suffer less because there is in me less strength to endure it. At your age we have faith in life. It is the privilege of youth to believe and hope. But old men see death more clearly. Oh, 'tis here. 'Tis here. 'Tis over. My sight is gone. My reason escapes your hand, Dantès. Adieu. Adieu. And raising himself by a final effort, in which he summoned all his faculties, he said, Monte Cristo, forget not, Monte Cristo. And he fell back in his bed. The crisis was terrible. His twisted limbs, his swollen eyelids, a foam of blood and froth in his lips, a frame quite rigid, were soon extended on this bed of agony in place of the intellectual being who was there but so lately. Dantès took the lamp, placed it on a projecting stone above the bed, whence its tremulous light fell with strange and fantastic ray on this discomposed countenance and this motionless and stiffened body. With fixed eyes, he awaited boldly the moment for administering the hoped-for restorative. When he believed the instant had arrived, he took the knife, unclosed the teeth, which offered less resistance than before, counted one after the other 12 drops, and watched. The phial contained, perhaps, twice as much more. He waited 10 minutes, a quarter of an hour, half an hour. Nothing moved. Trembling, his hair erect, his brow bathed with perspiration, he counted the seconds by the beatings of his heart. Then he thought it was time to make the last trial, and he put the phial to the violet lips of Faria, and without having occasion to force open his jaws, which had remained extended, he poured the whole of the liquid down his throat. The draught produced a galvanic effect. A violent trembling pervaded the old man's limbs. His eyes opened until it was fearful to gaze upon them. He heaved a sigh which resembled a shriek, and then all this vibrating frame returned gradually to its state of immobility, only the eyes remaining open. Half an hour, an hour and a half elapsed, and during this time of anguish, Edmund leaned over his friend, his hand applied to his heart, and felt the body gradually grow cold, and the heart's pulsation become more and more deep and dull, until at length all stopped. The last movement of the heart ceased, the face became livid, the eyes remained open, but the look was glazed. It was 6 o'clock in the morning. The dawn was just breaking, and its weak ray came into the dungeon and paled the ineffectual light of the lamp. Singular shadows passed over the countenance of the dead man, which at times gave it the appearance of life. Whilst this struggle between day and night lasted, Dantès still doubted. But as soon as the daylight gained the preeminence, he saw that he was alone with a corpse. Then an invincible and extreme terror seized upon him, and he dared not again press the hand that hung out of bed. He dared no longer to gaze on those fixed and vacant eyes, which he tried many times to close, but in vain. They opened again as soon as shut. He extinguished the lamp, carefully concealed it, and then went away, closing as well as he could the entrance to the secret passage by the large stone as he descended. It was time, for the jailer was coming. On this occasion he began his rounds at Dante's cell, and on leaving him he went on to Faria's dungeon, where he was taking breakfast and some linen. Nothing betokened that the man knew anything of what had occurred. He went on his way. Dantès was then seized with an indescribable desire to know what was going on in the dungeon of his unfortunate friend. He therefore returned by the subterraneous gallery, and arrived in time to hear the exclamations of the turnkey, who called out for help. Other turnkeys came, and then was heard the regular tramp of soldiers even when not on duty. Behind them came the governor. Edmund heard the creaking of the bed in which they were moving the corpse, heard the voice of the governor who desired them to throw water on the face, and seeing that in spite of this application the prisoner did not recover, sent for the doctor. The governor then went out, and some words of pity fell on Dante's listening ears, mingled with brutal laughter. "Well, well," said one, "the madman has gone to look after his treasure. Good journey to him. With all his millions he will not have enough to pay for his shroud," said another. "Oh," added a third voice, "the shrouds of the Chateau d'If are not dear." "Perhaps," said one of the previous speakers, "as he was a churchman, they may go to some expense in his behalf. They may give him the honours of the sack." Edmund did not lose a word, but comprehended very little of what was said. The voices soon ceased, and it seemed to him as if the persons had all left the cell. Still, he dared not to enter, as they might have left some turnkey to watch the dead. He remained, therefore, mute and motionless, restraining even his respiration. At the end of an hour, he heard a faint noise which increased. It was the governor who returned, followed by the doctor and other attendants. There was a moment's silence. It was evident that the doctor was examining the dead body. The inquiries soon commenced. The doctor analyzed the symptoms of the malady under which the prisoner had sunk, and declared he was dead. Questions and answers followed in a manner that made Dantès indignant, for he felt that all the world should experience for the poor abbé the love he bore him. "I am very sorry for what you tell me," said the governor, replying to the assurance of the doctor, "that the old man is really dead, for he was a quiet, inoffensive prisoner, happy in his folly and required no watching." "Ah," added the turnkey, "there was no occasion for watching him. He would have stayed here 50 years, I'll answer for it, without any attempt to escape." "Still," said the governor, "I believe it will be requisite, notwithstanding your certainty, and not that I doubt your science, but for my own responsibility's sake, that we should be perfectly assured that the prisoner is dead."
There was a moment of complete silence, during which Dantès, still listening, felt assured that the doctor was examining and touching the corpse a second time. "You may make your mind easy," said the doctor. "He is dead. I will answer for that." "You know, sir," said the governor, persisting, "that we are not content in such cases as this with such a simple examination. In spite of all appearances, be so kind, therefore, as finish your duty by fulfilling the formalities prescribed by law." "Let the irons be heated," said the doctor, "but really it is a useless precaution." This order to heat the irons made Dantès shudder. He heard hasty steps, the creaking of a door, people going and coming, and some minutes afterwards a turnkey entered, saying, "Here is the brazier lighted." There was a moment's silence, and then was heard the noise made by burning flesh, of which the peculiar and nauseous smell penetrated even behind the wall where Dantès was listening, horrified. At this smell of human flesh carbonized, the damp came over the young man's brow, and he felt as if he should faint. "You see, sir, he is really dead," said the doctor. "This burn in the heel is decisive. The poor fool is cured of his folly and delivered from his captivity."
"Wasn't his name Faria?" inquired one of the officers who accompanied the governor.
"Yes, sir, and, as he said, it was an ancient name. He was, too, very learned, and rational enough on all points which did not relate to his treasure, but on that, indeed, he was obstinate. It is the sort of malady which we call monomania," said the doctor. "You had never anything to complain of?" said the governor to the jailer who had charge of the abbé.
"Never, sir," replied the jailer. "Never, on the contrary. He sometimes amused me very much by telling me stories. One day, too, when my wife was ill, he gave me a prescription which cured her."
"Ah, ah," said the doctor. "I was ignorant that I had a competitor. But I hope, Monsieur le Gouverneur, that you will show him all proper respect in consequence."
Yes, yes, make your mind easy. He shall be decently interred in the newest sack we can find. Will that satisfy you?"
"Must we do this last formality in your presence, sir?" inquired a turnkey.
"Certainly. But make haste, I cannot stay here all day."
Fresh footsteps going and coming were now heard, and a moment afterwards the noise of cloth being rubbed reached Dante's ears. The bed creaked on its hinges, and the heavy foot of a man who lifts a weight resounded on the floor. Then the bed again creaked under the weight deposited upon it.
"In the evening," said the governor. "Will there be any mass?" asked one of the attendants.
"That is impossible," replied the governor. "The chaplain of the chateau came to me yesterday to beg for leave of absence in order to take a trip to Ayer for a week. I told him I would attend to the prisoners in his absence. If the poor abbe had not been in such a hurry, he might have had his requiem. "Pooh, pooh," said the doctor, with the accustomed impiety of persons of his profession. "He is a churchman. God will respect his profession, and not give the devil the wicked delight of sending him a priest." A shout of laughter followed this brutal jest. During this time the operation of putting the body in the sack was going on. "This evening," said the governor, when the task was ended. "At what o'clock?" inquired a turnkey. "Why, about 10 or 11 o'clock. Shall we watch by the corpse?" "Of what use would it be? Shut the dungeon as if he were alive, that is all." Then the steps retreated, and the voices died away in the distance. The noise of the door with its creaking hinges and bolts ceased, and a silence, duller than any solitude, ensued, the silence of death, which pervaded all, and struck its icy chill through the young man's whole frame. Then he raised the flagstone cautiously with his head, and looked carefully round the chamber. It was empty, and Dantès, quitting the passage, entered it. 20. The Cemetery of the Château d'If. On the bed at full length, and faintly lighted by the pale ray that penetrated the window, was visible a sack of coarse cloth, under the large folds of which were stretched a long and stiffened form. It was Faria's last winding sheet, a winding sheet which, as the turnkey said, cost so little. All then was completed. A material separation had taken place between Dantès and his old friend. He could no longer see those eyes which had remained open, as if to look even beyond death. He could no longer clasp that hand of industry which had lifted for him the veil that had concealed hidden and obscure things. Faria, the usual and the good companion, with whom he was accustomed to live so intimately, no longer breathed. He seated himself on the edge of that terrible bed, and fell into a melancholy and gloomy reverie. Alone. He was alone again. Again relapsed into silence. He found himself once again in the presence of nothingness. Alone, no longer to see, no longer to hear the voice of the only human being who attached him to life. Was it not better, like Faria, to seek the presence of his Maker and learn the enigma of life at the risk of passing through the mournful gate of intense suffering? The idea of suicide, driven away by his friend and forgotten in his presence whilst living, arose like a phantom before him in presence of his dead body. "If I could die," he said, "I should go where he goes and should assuredly find him again. But how to die? It is very easy," he continued with a smile of bitterness. "I will remain here, rush on the first person that opens the door, will strangle him, and then they will guillotine me." But as it happens that in excessive griefs, as in great tempests, the abyss is found between the tops of the loftiest waves, Dantès recoiled from the idea of this infamous death, and passed suddenly from despair to an ardent desire for life and liberty. "Die? Oh, no," he exclaimed, "not die now, after having lived and suffered so long and so much. Die? Yes, had I died years since, but now it would be indeed to give way to my bitter destiny. No, I desire to live. I desire to struggle to the very last. I wish to reconquer the happiness of which I have been deprived. Before I die, I must not forget that I have my executioners to punish, and perhaps too, who knows, some friends to reward. Yet they will forget me here, and I shall die in my dungeon like Faria." As he said this, he remained motionless, his eyes fixed like a man struck with a sudden idea, but whom this idea fills with amazement. Suddenly he rose, lifted his hand to his brow as if his brain were giddy, paced twice or thrice round his chamber, and then paused abruptly at the bed. "Ah, ah," he muttered. "Who inspires me with this thought? Is that thou, gracious God,
since none but the dead pass freely from this dungeon, let me assume the place of the dead."
Without giving himself time to reconsider his decision, and indeed that he might not allow his thoughts to be distracted from his desperate resolution, he bent over the appalling sack, opened it with the knife which Faria had made, drew the corpse from the sack, and transported it along the gallery to his own chamber, laid it on his couch, passed round its head the rag he wore at night round his own, covered it with his counterpane, once again kissed the ice-cold brow, and tried vainly to close the resisting eyes which glared horrible, turned the head towards the wall so that the jailer might, when he brought his evening meal, believe that he was asleep, as was his frequent custom, returned along the gallery, threw the bed against the wall, returned to the other cell, took from the hiding place the needle and thread, flung off his rags that they might feel naked flesh only beneath the coarse sackcloth, and getting inside the sack, placed himself in the posture in which the dead body had been laid, and sewed up the mouth of the sack with inside. The beating of his heart might have been heard if, by any mischance, the jailers had entered at that moment. Dantès might have waited until the evening visit was over, but he was afraid the governor might change his resolution and order the dead body to be removed earlier. In that case, his last hope would have been destroyed. Now his project was settled under any circumstances, and he hoped thus to carry it into effect. If, during the time he was being conveyed, the gravediggers should discover that they were conveying a live instead of a dead body, Dantès did not intend to give them time to recognize him, but with a sudden cut of the knife, he meant to open the sack from top to bottom, and, profiting by their alarm, escape. If they tried to catch him, he would use his knife. If they conducted him to the cemetery and laid him in the grave, he would allow himself to be covered with earth, and then, as it was night, the gravediggers could scarcely have turned their backs ere he would have worked his way through the soft soil and escape, hoping that the weight would not be too heavy for him to support. If he was deceived in this and the earth proved too heavy, he would be stifled, and then, so much the better, all would be over. Dantès had not eaten since the previous evening, but he had not thought of hunger or thirst, nor did he now think of it. His position was too precarious to allow him even time to reflect on any thought but one. The first risk that Dantès ran was that the jailer, when he brought him his supper at 7 o'clock, might perceive the substitution he had effected. Fortunately, 20 times at least from misanthropy or fatigue, Dantès had received his jailer in bed, and then the man placed his bread and soup on the table and went away without saying a word. This time the jailer might not be as silent as usual, but speak to Dantès, and seeing that he received no reply, go to the bed and thus discover all. When 7 o'clock came, Dantès' agony really commenced. His hand, placed on his heart, was unable to repress its throbbings, whilst with the other he wiped the perspiration from his temples. From time to time shudderings ran through his whole frame and collapsed his heart as if it were frozen. Then he thought he was going to die, yet the hours passed on without any stir in the chateau, and Dantès felt he had escaped this first danger. It was a good augury. At length, about the hour the governor had appointed, footsteps were heard on the stairs. Edmund felt that the moment had arrived, and summoning up all his courage, held his breath, happy if at the same time he could have repressed in like manner the hasty pulsation of his arteries. They stopped at the door. There were 2 steps, and Dantès guessed it was the 2 gravediggers who had come to seek him. This idea was soon converted into certainty when he heard the noise they made in putting down the hand-bier. The door opened, and a dim light reached Dante's eyes through the coarse sack that covered him. He saw 2 shadows approach his bed, a 3rd remaining at the door with a torch in his hand. Each of these 2 men, approaching the ends of the bed, took the sack by its extremities. "He's heavy, though, for an old and thin man," said one as he raised the head. "They say every year adds 1/2 pound to the weight of the bones," said another, lifting the feet. "Have you tied the knot?" inquired the 1st speaker. "What would be the use of carrying so much more weight?" was the reply. "I can do that when we get there." "Yes, you're right," replied the companion. "What's the knot for?" thought Dantès. They deposited the supposed corpse on the bier. Edmund stiffened himself in order to play his part of a dead man, and then the party, lighted by the man with the torch who went first, ascended the stairs. Suddenly he felt the fresh and sharp night air, and Dantès recognized the Mistral. It was a sudden sensation, at the same time replete with delight and agony. The bearers advanced 20 paces, then stopped, putting their bier down on the ground. One of them went away, and Dantès heard his shoes on the pavement. "Where am I, then?" he asked himself. "Really, he is by no means a light load," said the other bearer, sitting on the edge of the hand-barrow. Dantès' first impulse was to escape, but fortunately he did not attempt it.
"Light me, you, sir," said the other bearer, "or I shall not find what I am looking for."
The man with the torch complied, although not asked in the most polite terms.
"What can he be looking for?" thought Edmund. "The spade, perhaps."
An exclamation of satisfaction indicated that the gravedigger had found the object of his search.
"Here it is at last," he said. "Not without some trouble, though."
"Yes," was the answer, "but it has lost nothing by waiting."
As he said this, the man came towards Edmund, who heard a heavy and sounding substance laid down beside him, and the same moment a cord was fastened round his feet with sudden and painful violence.
"Well, have you tied the knot?" inquired the gravedigger, who was looking on.
"Yes, and pretty tight, too, I can tell you," was the answer.
"Move on, then."
And the bier was lifted once more, and they proceeded. They advanced 50 paces farther, and then stopped to open a door, then went forward again. The noise of the waves dashing against the rocks on which the chateau is built reached Dante's ears distinctly as they progressed.
"Bad weather," observed one of the bearers. "Not a pleasant night for a dip in the sea."
"Why, yes, the abbé runs a chance of being wet," said the other, and then there was a burst of brutal laughter.
Dantès did not comprehend the jest, but his hair stood erect on his head.
"Well, here we are at last," said one of them. "A little farther, a little farther," said the other. "You know very well that the last was stopped on his way, dashed on the rocks, and the governor told us next day that we were careless fellows."
They ascended 5 or 6 more steps, and then Dantès felt that they took him, one by the head and the other by the heels, and swung him to and fro.
"One," said the gravediggers, "two, three, and away."
And at the same instant Dantès felt himself flung into the air like a wounded bird, falling with a rapidity that made his blood curdle. Although drawn downwards by the same heavy weight which hastened his rapid descent, it seemed to him as if the time were a century. At last, with a terrific dash, he entered the ice-cold water, and as he did so he uttered a shrill cry, stifled in a moment by his immersion beneath the waves. Dantès had been flung into the sea, into whose depths he was dragged by a 36-pound shot tied to his feet. The sea is the cemetery of Château d'If.
21. The Isle of Tiboulon.
Dantès, although giddy and almost suffocated, had yet sufficient presence of mind to hold his breath, and as his right hand, prepared as he was for every chance, held his knife open, he rapidly ripped up the sack, extricated his arm, and then his body, but in spite of all his efforts to free himself from the bullet, he felt it dragging him down still lower. He then bent his body and by a desperate effort severed the cord that bound his legs at the moment he was suffocating. With a vigorous spring he rose to the surface of the sea, whilst the bullet bore to its depths the sack that had so nearly become his shroud. Dantès merely paused to breathe, and then dived again in order to avoid being seen. When he arose a second time, he was 50 paces from where he had first sunk. He saw overhead a black and tempestuous sky, over which the wind was driving the fleeting vapours that occasionally suffered a twinkling star to appear. Before him was the vast expanse of waters, sombre and terrible, whose waves foamed and roared as if before the approach of a storm. Behind him, blacker than the sea, blacker than the sky, rose like a phantom the giant of granite, whose projecting crags seemed like arms extended to seize their prey.
and on the highest rock was a torch that lighted two figures. He fancied these two forms were looking at the sea. Doubtless these strange gravediggers had heard his cry. Dantès dived again and remained a long time beneath the water. This manoeuvre was already familiar to him, and usually attracted a crowd of spectators in the bay before the lighthouse at Marseille when he swam there, who, with one accord, pronounced him the best swimmer in the port. When he rose again, the light had disappeared. It was necessary to strike out to sea. Ratonneau and Pomègue are the nearest isles of all those that surround the Château d'If, but Ratonneau and Pomègue are inhabited, together with the islet of Dorme. Tiboulon or Lemaire were the most secure. The isles of Tiboulon and Lemaire are a league from the Château d'If. Dantès, nevertheless, determined to make for them. But how could he find his way in the darkness of the night? At this moment he saw before him, like a brilliant star, the lighthouse of Planier. By leaving this light on the right, he kept the isle of Tiboulon a little on the left. By turning to the left, therefore, he would find it. But, as we have said, it was at least a league.